This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
A stunning split-screen moment. On the one hand, at the same hour, Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial. On the other hand, the Supreme Court of the United States hearing oral arguments about presidential immunity. And so, trying to juggle both of these, let's get to story number one. Let me start with SCOTUS, because I'm not a lawyer, but I have covered the courts over the years, and listening to the questions asked by justices from both the right and the left, I don't see any way that the Supreme Court is going to grant a president, this is a particular case, obviously, on appeal from former President Trump, but any future president, blanket immunity from prosecution. I just don't see it. Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, very much on the defensive. So just to give you a sense, Sauer's making the difficult case that there's a distinction to be made between official acts and unofficial acts. Acts done solely for the private gain of the president. And every justice is trying to get him to explain the distinction with increasingly dramatic hypothetical examples. For example, Chief Justice John Roberts. Well, what if the president does something in exchange for a bribe? Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Some things are so fundamentally evil, they have to be protected against. For example, what if the president orders the military or someone else to assassinate a political rival? Is that an official act? Sauer acknowledges, well, the president would be doing that for personal gain. Clarence Thomas, how do you determine official act? Neil Gorsuch, no man is above the law. He goes back to the founders who were rebelling against a king who did have unlimited power and was above the law, specifically not granting blanket immunity to future presidents. Sam Alito, trying to give the lawyer a little bit more leeway. Why is immunity essential for the proper functioning of the presidency? But even that is kind of a skeptical question. Here is Alito. Again, one might argue it is plausible to order SEAL Team 6. Now, that reference, and he says, I'm not trying to, smear SEAL Team 6, but, in earlier arguments, the question has come up. President orders this elite military unit, SEAL Team 6, to assassinate a political rival. You could say, well, it's an official act insofar as he does have authority over SEAL Team 6, but for that purpose? And you can just, all we have is the audio, but you can just hear the lawyer backtracking and trying to carve out a space that will protect his client against this sort of onslaught of questions. Remember, this is the Supreme Court that said Donald Trump cannot be thrown off state ballots in places like Colorado and Maine, under the 14th Amendment. So Trump got the win there. Here, the skepticism is just palpable. Justice Roberts comes up with another sort of mind twister. So let's say, according to the Chief Justice, you are doing something that could certainly be considered an official act, appointing an ambassador. But you get money in exchange for that. You're selling the ambassadorship and you're being bribed. Sotomayor jumps in. It's an official appointment because Trump's lawyer is arguing that anything that is deemed to be, and exactly how you do this is tricky. Anything that is deemed to be an official act, Trump's attorney says, should be expunged from any indictment. But Roberts comes back. Well, this is an official act. But what if you're then taking money for it? Arizona, false slate of elections. The lawyer says, well, that could be an official act. Another question from Justice Kagan. Selling nuclear secrets. That was sort of left muddled. I don't know why. Kagan again. If the president orders the military to stage a coup, and that it was later clarified, she later clarified that this was not about a coup in, you know, some South American country. A coup here at home. He wanted to stay in office. He didn't want to leave. Sounds familiar. Depends on the circumstances, said Sauer. She didn't let him get off with that. She said, it sure sounds bad, doesn't it? And he had to agree. So this is all about the question of where should the line be drawn? And I think all the justices that I've heard so far are saying, yeah, there should be a line. It's difficult to draw. Congress often passes vague laws. And yes, something that is purely, you couldn't even imagine an official justification, purely for a president's personal gain. Coup, assassination, bribery. That could be prosecuted. So just by acknowledging that, the Supreme Court, if it does come down with some kind of split the difference ruling, is not going to say, based on this hearing, and I don't usually make predictions, but you know, it's not like it's breaking down along liberal conservative lines. It's not going to say that there's no circumstance under which a president, at least a former president, because presidents have been assumed to be immune from indictment while in office, that at least a former president, which Donald Trump, of course, is now, cannot be criminally prosecuted in some circumstances. Now, if we move on to the Trump trial, at this moment, haven't yet gotten to Stormy Daniels, but a lot of testimony about Karen McDougal. That was begun on Tuesday before the court ran out of time. Karen McDougal, just to refresh the recollection, and by the way, David Pecker, the former National Enquirer publisher on the stand, cites Trump as saying that she is a 12 out of 10. So he certainly was enamored of her looks. The deal that they were working out with Karen McDougal, which was ultimately a payment advanced by the National Enquirer or parent company AMI, because she was going to write for these other magazines like OK and there's another one, escapes me at the moment. She didn't want to be the next Monica Lewinsky. She wanted to restart her career. In other words, Karen McDougal's position during these negotiations is, yeah, she could have gone public, but then she would be, you know, kind of dismissed as a bimbo or something, although she says she and Donald Trump, which Donald Trump vehemently denies, had a 10-month romantic relationship. Trump is speaking to Pecker. She's a nice girl. Is it true there's a Mexican group looking to buy her story for $8 million? Pecker said he didn't believe it was true. What do you think I should do? Says Donald Trump. Pecker testifying. I think you should buy the story and take it off the market. Pecker says that he, Pecker, believed the story to be true and that he wanted to spare Trump embarrassment to himself and also to his family. In that instance, but I think there may be other instances of the contrary. He doesn't mention the campaign. And that is a good line of defense for Trump, you know, just to spare him personal embarrassment. Okay, how is the money going to be handled? Michael Cohen, Pecker says, told him the boss will take care of it. He clarified that the boss was Donald Trump. Pecker says he knows Cohen didn't have the authority to disperse funds from the Trump organization. In fact, every time they had lunch, Pecker paid. They were buying lifetime rights for that $150K from Kara McDougal, including any information she had about a physical or personal relationship she had with a then married man. I think it's pretty obvious. And just, you know, so that there's no confusion here, Pecker, upon further questioning, said they were trying to bury the Donald Trump story, make sure it never came out. But since she wanted to start a career, they would pay her to write a fitness column, which, by the way, would be written by ghostwriters. She would get to approve any image of her that appeared in any of these magazines. Yes, Pecker said, this was meant to disguise the true nature of her intimate relationship with Donald Trump. Did Donald Trump know about this? Did he know about the payments? Pecker, I believe Donald Trump knew. And as you may recall, Pecker had his editor-in-chief of the Inquirer, Dylan Howard, go out to California, negotiate the deal, talk to Karen McDougal, come up with the details about the payment and the column she wanted to write. And the contract was signed in early August of 2016. Remember, the whole point of this is to make sure it doesn't come out before the election. But then there's this detour having to do with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because when Pecker and AMI were in the process of buying these fitness magazines, Arnold, as you know, world champion weightlifter, had been on the cover, it was 60 or 70 times. And he was obviously the one who enabled the sales to be as good as they were. And so Pecker, negotiating with Arnold, confronts this demand. Schwarzenegger says, you must run no negative stories about me now or in the future because I'm planning to run for governor. This is before the 2000 recall election. Pecker didn't want to go for that. He said the Inquirer had been approached by a number of women about their relationships with Arnold. He came up with a compromise. He, meaning on behalf of American Media Inc., would buy some Arnold stories and quash them. And these were allegations coming from women who were calling the Inquirer. But not all of them. And some of the women took these allegations to the Los Angeles Times, which did publish them. This was very embarrassing for me, said Pecker, and the company. And there was a state investigation. And again, he says, all of this, the real reason for this contract was not to get Karen McDougal's face into the fitness magazines or her columns, or she wanted to be an anchor one day. It was to argue that it was to lock her up, not in the let's go to jail sense, recalling the chants against Hillary in 2016, but to nail down an agreement that she would never go public about her alleged relationship with Donald Trump. And that worked until it didn't. And she ended up going public, or the Wall Street Journal got the story. And next up, I'm sure, will be Stormy Daniels. That's where we are right now on both of these momentous legal proceedings. Meanwhile, a bombshell indictment in Arizona, where a grand jury indicted seven lawyers and aides who had worked for Donald Trump's 2020 campaign. And you'll recognize many of the names. Mark Meadows, former White House Chief of Staff. Rudy Giuliani. Jenna Ellis, who also was charged in the Georgia case. John Eastman. Christina Bobb, top campaign advisor Boris Epstein. And former campaign aide Mike Roman. All of them charged with this fake electors scheme. Where, remember, Arizona was won by Joe Biden by just over 10,000 votes. So the people involved here, oh, I guess you're wondering about Donald Trump. He is an unindicted co-conspirator. And so Arizona, by the way, the fourth state now after Michigan, Georgia, Nevada, to pursue charges against those who formed, they would call it an alternate slate of electors. Fake electors, I think, is the right term. And to look at this, meanwhile, 11 Arizona Republicans were also indicted in this case. And the names are not listed in the indictment, but pretty widely known here. Washington Post is able to identify them through the details of the indictment. And also the chief operating officer of the campaign arm of Turning Point USA. Anyway, I don't know what took so long. All this happened 4 years ago. The state AG investigating this for a year. But yet another legal front and more legal problems for the likes of Rudy and Meadows and some of the lesser names. And as long as we're talking about Arizona, you recall the 1864 law that suddenly, according to the state's Supreme Court was revived. This is, you know, a ban on abortion in all cases except to save the life of the mother. Well, the Arizona House actually voted yesterday to get rid of that law. And Republicans control both chambers in Arizona, but three Republicans broke ranks voting with the Democrats to repeal the ban. Now, it has to still be approved by the state Senate, where Republicans also have an edge. Democratic rep quote is saying, the people of Arizona are waiting for us to get this done. And you know who also wants them to get this done? Donald Trump, who came out and said that this will be fixed in a couple of weeks. Well, maybe, maybe not. It took defecting Republicans to get to this point, which I guess you would call the halfway point. All right, story number two. If you can bear with me through yet another Supreme Court segment here. Oral arguments yesterday. This is going to be a big deal. Should federal law allow doctors to perform emergency abortions in states that have near total bans on the procedure? So you can see where this is pretty high stakes. In these oral arguments, it has to do with Idaho. And the law in that state limits access to abortion unless the life of the pregnant woman is in danger. And the questioning by the justices is interesting. So for the administration, Biden's Solicitor General, Elizabeth Prelogar, said what Idaho is doing is waiting for women to wait and deteriorate and suffer the lifelong health consequences with no possible upside for the fetus. It just stacks tragedy upon tragedy. Now, on the liberal side, Elena Kagan saying it can't be the right standard of care to force somebody onto a helicopter. I guess meeting for emergency care at the last minute. Now, several of the conservative justices were, you will not be shocked to hear, skeptical of the federal government's argument. Here's Sam Alito. How can you impose restrictions on what Idaho can criminalize simply because hospitals in Idaho have chosen to participate in Medicare? I guess saying, why is this a federal issue? But Amy Coney Barrett, the last Trump appointee and a conservative, also joined in the tough questioning. You know, I mean, it's just a biological fact. Women, some women, are going to look at these issues differently. Sonia Sotomayor said, doctors should be allowed, responding to an argument, about doctors being allowed to make a determination whether a patient's life is in danger, whether their water broke, or they needed a hysterectomy and an abortion. Sotomayor, she can no longer have children, all right? You're telling me the doctor there couldn't have done the abortion earlier? And the lawyer for the other side said, again, it goes back to whether a doctor can, in good faith, medical judgment. That's a lot for the doctor to risk, said Sotomayor.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now, let's turn to number three. Lots of fireworks and developments on the campus protests. But first, I want to talk just for a second about the president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq. Well, somebody dug this up. This is 2 months after these attacks of September 11th. And Shafiq says, you'll always have individuals who have extreme views. But what's really troubling is that there's actually quite a broad base of society which has some sympathy for the terrorists. Not so much because they approve of their methods, but it's a form of protesting against a system which is not delivering for them on the economic or the political front. So sympathy from Shafiq, this is over 20 years ago. Terrorism is protesting. Now, her defenders will say, oh, she's just trying to understand the motivation. But come on. If you can't condemn 9/11, no wonder you're having problems with this horrible situation on your campus, where you keep setting deadlines for more arrests and then keep negotiating with people who, it's kind of whitewashes it to just say pro-Palestinian protesters. These are people who are pro-Hamas, who favor killing Jews, who want to wipe Israel off the map. Maybe not all of them, but a good chunk of them. So, I was watching live yesterday at Columbia, where I went to journalism school. The architecture very familiar to me. And here's House Speaker Mike Johnson showing up with a handful of Republican congressmen. And he met with a group of Jewish students. He met briefly with Shafiq. And then he came out to address the television cameras and the people who are there on campus. Whatever you think of Johnson, and he's getting a lot of praise from the media right now, because, you got to give him credit for getting aid to Ukraine and aid to Israel through a seemingly paralyzed House. But what he did here was he created a moment. He knew the protesters would try to shout him down. Joe Biden should have gone to Columbia and given a speech. Like when there's a disaster, you go where there's a hurricane, you go where there's an earthquake, you go where a bridge collapses in Baltimore. And this is a different kind of disaster. So Johnson says, and look, he just got $26 billion in aid for Israel. I'm here joining my colleagues today, calling on President Shafiq to resign if, he adds the if this time, if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. As Speaker of the House, I'm committed today that Congress will not be silent as Jewish students are expected to run for their lives and stay home from their classes, hiding in fear. That's essentially what's happened at Columbia and some other schools, where they say, you know, okay, you have a choice for the last 3 or 4 weeks of the semester. You can come to in-person classes. Well, what Jewish student in his or her right mind is going to do that right now? Or you can stay home and study remotely, you know, which became popular during the pandemic. So he's standing near the Low Library, which is this towering structure that sort of forms the skyline at Columbia. The protesters, some of whom are in those tents, and some of whom were outside the gates up on 116th Street in Upper Manhattan, and they're heckling him, you know? They're shouting, "Free Palestine." They're shouting, "Stop the genocide." They're shouting, "From the river to the sea," meaning Palestine will take over all that land and there will be no more Israel. "Get off our campus. Go back to Louisiana, Mike." And Johnson, I thought, handled himself well. He said, "Enjoy your free speech," because he made a point in saying, you know, peaceful protests are okay. This sort of takeover of a campus is not. And then they all broke into a chant of, "Mike, you suck. Mike, you suck." Now, is that utterly disrespectful to the Speaker of the House? Yes. But that's not the era we live in anymore. I mean, you have members of Congress. Remember when President Obama was speaking to a joint session and a certain member shouted out, "You lie." Johnson went on to say, if the campuses can't get control of this problem, they don't deserve taxpayer dollars, because private universities like Columbia get taxpayer dollars as well. They're going to work on legislation, says Johnson. He thinks there's bipartisan agreement. And he's not the only one. The day before, Monday, 2 days before, several Democratic Jewish members of Congress, Jared Moskowitz, Kathy Manning, Josh Gottheimer, went there and said, according to Gottheimer, "Imagine trying to study for finals at Columbia while people outside the library are calling for your death. To the administrators at Columbia and beyond, here are our demands. Stop the double talk. Start acting. Discipline harassers. Restore civility on this campus." And earlier yesterday, Speaker Johnson had shared a meal with the university's rabbi. And he said, if this is not contained quickly, there is an appropriate time for the National Guard to come in. And that would be a presidential decision. Of course, you run the risk of escalating, I suppose. And that's what's happening at Columbia. And, you know, more arrests at other schools. The list goes on and on. I read that half of the top 50 universities and colleges in America have had major league protests. And I'm sure there are more to come. So here's Rich Lowry in National Review. Is there space for more haters at Columbia University? Imagine if a contingent of alt-right students established their own encampment on a corner of the quad and began to shout anti-Semitic slogans. Say the infamous chant, "Jews will not replace us," from the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. This is in Trump's first year, 2017. Would Shafiq hesitate to have them arrested as many times as necessary? Would a huge contingent of faculty walk out? That's really amazing. To protest the arrests? Would the president of Barnard quickly lift the suspensions of the arrested students? The answers are no, never, and of course not. So Rich goes on to argue about a gross double standard, depending on who is doing the protesting. The anti-Semitism of the right is considered morally abhorrent and inherently threatening. Well, I mean, what we're seeing now in places like Columbia, it's really hard to argue with that. The anti-Semitism of the left, Lowry argues, is very often ignored. explained away or viewed as a regrettable excess. The protests at Columbia have been widely criticized, but they've also garnered elite sympathy, most notably from supportive left-wing members of Congress and the school's own faculty, who've been restraining Shafiq, he says. More than 1,400 academics from different schools are calling for a boycott of Columbia for being too tough on the protesters. They've taken over the campus. They've driven the Jewish students off of one of the most prestigious and beautiful campuses in America. And so basically this is the double standard argument. If blacks were protesting, if others were protesting, if gays were protesting, would this be handled differently? Through the perverse prism of the woke left, alt-right anti-Semites are victimizers, but pro-Hamas anti-Semites are the victims. All right, number four, David Brooks, moderate conservative, pro-Biden columnist in the New York Times, says this: I still believe Biden is the party's strongest candidate, but I'm getting more pessimistic about his chances of winning. Voters prefer the Republicans on key issues like inflation and immigration. Most Donald Trump supporters I know aren't swept up in his cult of personality. They vote for him because they are conservative types who like GOP policies and think Trump is a more effective executive than Biden. Second reason, NBC poll, interest in this election lower than in any other presidential election in almost 20 years. Only 64% of Americans say they have a high degree of interest, compared to 77% in 2020. Now, that may change as we get closer to November, but Brooks says he imagines it's partly because it's hard to get enthusiastic about candidates who are a half century older than you, but part of it is about Biden's approach to the Israel-Hamas war. Here we go again. Young people are much more critical of Israel than other groups, and there are no candidates representing that point of view. I think, says Brooks, what we're seeing at Columbia and on other elite campuses is a precursor of what we're going to see at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And when you say Democratic Convention in Chicago, what comes to mind? 1968, and the clashes between the New Left activists and Mayor Richard Daley's police force, the senior Daley, who was mayor roughly forever. If there are similar clashes in Chicago this August, the chaos will reinforce Trump's core law and order message and make Biden look weak and hapless. I just throw in, David, that Trump's core law and order message. Well, certainly people care about chaos in the streets and they care about this war. And a lot of younger people just think that the U.S. is backing a regime that is responsible, and leaving aside the inconvenient fact that Israel was attacked brutally, that grandparents, parents, children, babies were massacred. But the average person cares most about safety in the streets. I was just going to say, the law and order message of Donald Trump could be complicated a bit by all of his criminal trials. The only one likely to be done before the election is this one, is the Alvin Bragg case, Stormy Daniels case. And Trump's own lawyer, Lena Haba, said in a television interview, she doesn't have high hopes. This is a deep blue borough, and she wasn't exactly talking up an optimistic message.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Finally, number five, a little bit of a look at Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's getting a lot of blowback for threatening the job of Mike Johnson. And all she has to do is bring that resolution to the floor, motion to vacate. And while the Democrats could bail out Johnson, they certainly are crediting him with working out the foreign aid compromise. Here's the Washington Post saying, you know, this all stems from Kevin McCarthy and allowing any one member to call to oust the speaker. Now, McCarthy told me that that was always the rule before, but Nancy Pelosi changed it. It changed back. It wasn't his doing. In any event, Republican Senator Tom Tillis on CNN called MTG a waste of time, a horrible leader. She is dragging our brand down. She, not the Democrats, are the biggest risk to us getting back to a majority. I'm embarrassed to actually have lived geographically in her district at one time before she was there. Also, New York Post cover over the weekend, Niet, Moscow Marjorie. The point being that by opposing aid to Ukraine, she's siding with Russia, doing Putin's business. Opinion columnist for Fox News did an online piece. Marjorie Taylor Greene is an idiot. She's trying to wreck the GOP. The Wall Street Journal, also like the Post, like Fox News, part of the Murdoch empire, called her Congresswoman Mayhem Taylor Greene. She and her crew of vandals prefer to scream and throw soup at the walls. Even Newsmax ran a piece, who put Marjorie Taylor Greene in charge? Well, she gained a lot of stature and became more of a serious lawmaker when she was a top and crucial ally for Kevin McCarthy. Now, many, even very conservative people on the right on Capitol Hill are turning on her. And I don't think she's going to back down. I don't know if she's going to go through with trying to seize the gavel from Mike Johnson. But I do know that she uses strong language. Some people love her. Some people can't stand her, including some people in her own party. And this melodrama is not over. Hey, thanks for sticking with us. Always enjoy talking to you. See you tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.